The things I want to say this morning sometimes may be taken a little hesitantly about Luther's success in the long time. I mean all in good faith, sir. But all the possibilities that presented themselves to Archbishop Thomas Cranmer on the judgment of Edward VI, the one that seems to have most basis to his purpose of advancing English Protestantism is the convening at Lambeth College of the Protestant Council, composed of leading continental reformers. Not only would such a council contribute to the establishing of one sound, pure evangelical doctrine agreeable to the discipline of the primitive church, but it would also provide Cranmer an opportunity for conferring directly with major continental reformers on theological questions about which he had not yet made a final decision. Although Cranmer had been at work for some time on the English prayer book, he had not yet solidified his opinions on principal problems such as the nature of the Eucharist, the ordination of priests, nor even the matter of ecclesiastical polity. During 1647, numerous continental Protestants gathered around Cranmer at Lambeth to aid him in making such decisions. Peter Alexander, who had been chaplain to Queen Mary of Hungary, Bernardino Urquino, who had been for a time the Italian minister of Geneva, and Peter Matter, who had been professor of theology at Strasbourg, all joined Cranmer at Lambeth in the first year of Edward's reign. But these men did not have the relatively long Protestant tradition behind them that the leaders at Wittenberg, Strasbourg, Zurich, and Geneva could boast. Cranmer was particularly anxious, therefore, to obtain aid from these Protestant centers. He wrote repeatedly to Philip Melanchthon, Luther's successor at Wittenberg, and to Martin Fichte, minister at Strasbourg, to encourage them to come to England. Not until later in Edward's reign did he seek out Henry Bullinger, who had taken the leadership at Zurich on the death of Cranmer. Now did Calvin of Geneva receive an early invitation from Cranmer, perhaps this has been suggested because of the strained Anglo-French situation at the beginning of Edward's reign. Three of these men, however, in their letters to Cranmer, displayed a deep concern for the advancement of English faith. As early as March 26, 1539, Melanchthon had written Cranmer from Wittenberg that there was a need for a consensus pia doctrina. Bichler wrote Cranmer a long letter in which he repeatedly praised the idea of church councils and stated that there are many commonwealths and countries whom, if we were duly to call them together, we should be able without any difficulty to draw over into an alliance of Christ. From Geneva, Calvin wrote, "As far as I am concerned, if it appears that I can be of any service, I shall not shrink from crossing 10 seas if need be." There is no comparable letter from Bellinger. His English correspondence did not reach Strasbourg to Perkins until John Hooper, who had been at Zurich with Bellinger from 1547 to 1549, returned to England in March of 1549. By the end of that year, however, the English relationship with Zurich was growing more cordial. On October 20th, Edward wrote the Senate to Zurich, "There is also a mutual agreement between us concerning the Christian relation and true godliness, which ought to render this friendship of ours by God's blessing yet more intimate." This protestation of friendship and the assurance of support from continental reformers do not always agree with these men's actual attitude toward England. A study of the men who came to England from these four centers indicates a great deal more about the continental leaders' relationship with England than do these former statements that I have just read you. Only one man of importance came to England from Geneva in the first years of Edward's reign. Anthony Rodolphe Chevalier, who had taught the English nobleman Thomas Bible Hebrew when he was in Geneva as a boy, came to England in 1548. He lived with Cranmer for about a year before taking up residence with the Italian immigrant Emmanuel Cornelius, who was then Hebrew professor at Cambridge. During his year with Cranmer, he was frequently consulted on matters of Old Testament interpretation, and at Cambridge he gave three Hebrew lectures. As a reward for his services at Lambeth and Cambridge, he was promised in 1552 the next canonry of seven to fall vacant in Canterbury Cathedral. In addition to his activities at Lambeth and Cambridge, he was also sent tutor to the Princess Elizabeth. The holding of this position is in itself an indication of the respect which Cranmer and Professor Somerset must have had for Chevalier's religious opinion. A person whose orthodoxy was suspect would not have been allowed for closer contact with the possible future sovereign. Chevalier's activities in the English church, university, and court are visible evidence that one Genevan is trying to see that the doctrine of God may be preached with strength and virtuous that have been forth through, as Calvin had suggested in a letter sent to Somerset. The representative to arrive from Wittenberg during the first years of Edward's reign, on the other hand, will have an entirely different story. Cranmer, knowing Melanchthon's interest in the United Protestant Church, wrote, I am aware that you have often desired that rising, godly men should take counsel together. We therefore request you to communicate your counsel and opinions to us in person. Instead of coming to England himself, however, Melanchthon sent over the younger Justice Jonas and Francis Dryander. Jonas, whose father Grecian catechism, Cranmer, had just finished having translated, had himself never made any contribution to the Reformation. In 1546, when Halle was captured by the Emperor in Marsh of Saxony, whom the elder Jonas had attacked, the family was forced to flee. Melanchthon, capitalizing on the family's name, seems to have sent Jonas to England more for the boy's own safety than for any aid Jonas might offer in advancing the Reformation in England. The second man to come to Melanchthon was only a few years older than Jonas, but a far more experienced Protestant. Francis Encinas, or Dryander as you sometimes call, born about 1520 of a noble Spanish family, went to Wittenberg to study with Melanchthon when he was not yet sent. After a visit to Paris in the Low Countries in 1541, he returned to Wittenberg where he finished the translation of the New Testament, a work that Melanchthon had encouraged him to undertake. This translation, intended for dedication to Charles V, so enraged Charles' confessor Pedro Alfonso that Encinas was imprisoned for a time. In March of 1545, however, he was back in Wittenberg again. Although Encinas spent the year 1546 with Luther in Strasbourg and corresponded frequently with Bullinger, he came to England in 1549 with letters of recommendation, not from Luther or Bullinger, but from his old teacher Melanchthon. While he was in England, Encinas tried to persuade others to come over also, but he seems to have regarded England as only a temporary place of refuge. For in December of 1549, he took his manuscript to the continent for publication, rather than having them published in England as other learned refugees had done. He never returned to England after 1549, and his last heard action, he wrote Melanchthon in 1542, that he hoped the new electoral attempt would, quote, have some plague, unquote. Encinas' refusal to participate more fully in English affairs seems to reflect Melanchthon's own attitude toward England. Although repeatedly professing an interest in England's spiritual welfare, Melanchthon consistently rejected Cranmer's offers for more active involvement in the English Reformation. The two men whom he sent to Cranmer both seem to have viewed England more as a green thicket for hiding than as a white field for harvesting. At least so John Hooper thought when he wrote Bulletin in 1550 concerning Encinas' return to the continent. He consults his own interests and cares but little for ours when gain is out of the question. From Strasbourg came two men who were both to devote their full energies for a number of years to the cause of Reformation in England. The first, John Utenhovius, the native of Ghent, had settled at Louvain and Cologne before he came to Strasbourg in 1545. But during that year, he was a member of the French church there, which was then under the pastorship of Valerian Turin. In the summer of 1548, Utenhovius came to England, where he was far more diplomatic than Encinas had been. Instead of antagonizing leaders of English faction, he seems to have made an effort to please them. Shortly after John Hooper's return from Zurich, Utenhovius established a friendship with him that resulted in Utenhovius being sent to Zurich, which Utenhovius writes, was celebrated above the rest both for its reputation and pure doctrine. Here he studied with Bullinger. He wrote in June of 1549 that the nobleman Utenhovius of Ghent has far exceeded your commendation of him, and I thank you that through the instrumentality of your staff and people I have contracted a friendship with a man in every way so worthy. Between them, Hooper and Bullinger managed to convert a promising man from Hooper's conservative Strasbourg training to their own more radical genuine point of view. The success of that effort is indicated in a letter which Utenhovius wrote to Bullinger in June of 1549. He writes, "Send me whatever you have of Bucer's and the Lord's Supper written by him before he began to boast." This same letter announces that Utenhovius is now ready to return to England. Obviously, the indoctrination process has been completed. On his return to England, he joined Hooper in his insistence on making no compromise with the more moderate reformer, a position Bucer himself would hardly have held. Before his departure from Zurich, Utenhovius had recommended another Strasbourg man to service in England. Late in 1548, he had recommended Valerian Turin, his former minister of Strasbourg, to Peter Marder, who had just left Lambeth to take a position at Oxford. Although Marder did not obtain a position for Turin at the university as had been anticipated, Turin almost immediately received Somerset patronage, which made it possible for him to acquire the politically significant position of superintendent of the Strangers' Church at Glastonbury. He gave every indication that he was anxious to settle in England and contribute to the advancement of the church there. 6 years after his arrival, he returned a letter of demonstration and left England only to go to England. Bacon himself came to England in April 1539 along with his friend Charles Savio. Cecil and others who feared his influence this summer were not happy to see him arrive. One English journalist expressed the suspicion of many in England who desired federal reform when he wrote Billinger, "May the Lord preserve our England from both of them." Stanley found in Bacon a man who would encourage him in his moderate position. Bacon's centric point of view in the Westphalian controversy and Eucharistic debate was agreeable to Stanley, but the Jewish group was too powerful a force to be subdued by moderation. Billinger sent one man, John Ab Almer, who was neither a scholar nor a person significant enough to exert much direct influence. Far more useful for Billinger's centers in England were the persistent efforts of native converts such as Luther and John Bacon, an English merchant who spent the years from 1533 to 1537 in Wales. Men such as these worked steadily to turn less fully committed men from Luther's somewhat ambiguous central position to the central world view of widespread reform. More or less regularly in England during the first years of Edward's reign, the genuine influence of the Jewish reformers was penetrating the thinking of those who came originally from Strasbourg and other continental centers. The Charles went far to sea. Although Calvin and Melanchthon both suppressed their interest in English religion, they failed to send to England a sizable number of useful churchmen to their position. Thus, the two continental central cities exerted most pressure on English affairs in the first years of Edward's rule for Zurich and Strasbourg. The Strasbourg position was a moderate one that was difficult to retain and difficult sometimes even to pursue. Consequently, what continental reformers who came to England discovered upon arrival was a group of rather able journalists, some of whom were Englishmen with all the advantageous connections of natives. Under the influence of this majority opinion, the foreigner who wished to receive preferment in England had little choice but to move toward what seemed to be the dominant position. Cranmer himself, in the years from 1537 to 1539, gives the impression that he was open to the suggestion of emigrants from any of the continental countries. Wittenberg lost his opportunity to influence in England by sending over unseasoned, uninterested men. Victor, who had trained his men in middle-of-the-road moderation, sent serious conscientious reformers, but their moderation worked against them in the strongly genuine atmosphere of the Hutterites. Consequently, the foreigners who obtained positions of power in the English church in the latter part of Edward's reign were those who had come originally from Strasbourg, men like Toulon and Utrecht, but who had been willing to adjust to the Zurich position after their arrival in England.
Writing the paper of the 10th in 1517 confirms his quote,
This 5-year-long war which is, you know, my enemies have waged against me. And the church, that he is cheered by the support of the church, all the learned men is honored. From whom I daily receive letters, declared I have never been the occasion of scandal to any man in my writings. Rather, that in the various languages I have striven to establish the church and the high spirit, which, through the diversity of all languages, has assembled the people in the unity of faith. These men observe too that our church desire brought great preeminence and that our before anyone else in the universe of church presented and taught the arts and studies of the Hebrew language. And I trust that you, most blessed Pope Leon, may best restore peace and tranquility to his powers in me because of my many and difficult labors for the Orthodox faith and the church. The opening statement of his religious day is on the first. But he is so kind and so that he and his fellow humanists are descending the pilgrim to which they are deeply committed. At the commencement of the 16th century, they come into being a wartime fellowship of intellectuals who suddenly present the appearance of being linked together in a joint enterprise. They were all dedicated certainly to the revival and conservation of the languages and literature that ancient Greek and Rome, and narrative of the purifying of the Latin tongue which had remained alive for so many centuries at the cost of becoming barbarized. The leading spirits of this fellowship were natives of England, France, and the German language. Woodland, Tigern, Humanist, and specifically Northern Humanist. There was no easy flow of humanism into the North. The intense scholastic curriculum of the Northern Universities proved a formidable obstacle. Their faculties stopped the very admission of the new enemy. English, French, and German scholars supported each other in the attack on scholastic questions. They were given international lay support by kings, high clergy, nobles, and men of wealth. The humanists had in Erasmus of Rotterdam, a real coordinator of the attack. He traveled around extensively, kept up a constant correspondence with his chief lieutenant. The defenders of the old curriculum had practically no international cohesion, no national great law at hand. The scholastics defended each citadel separately. In many places they were forced to admit the invaders and were then vanquished in the south within the gates. At once the foreign faculty thought they saw already turn the tables. They had found an issue over which they were prepared to go all out. Their first anti-intellectual named Pfefferkorn had been converted from Judaism in 1506. He became an ardent Christian proselytizer and soon focused his energies in an attack on all Jewish books except the Old Testament. The Dominicans of the University of Cologne decided to support him. The high office swung into action, and in 1509 the Emperor Maximilian was persuaded to order the Jews to surrender their books. However, the planet of Germany, the Archbishop of Mainz, demanded the more expert judgment be sought. The upshot was that Pfefferkorn invited an opinion from the Heidelberg professor Ersten, the very man who had been introducing Hebrew studies into Germany. Ersten defended the Hebrew books in the battle of his own. Pfefferkorn attacked him in a pamphlet, and Ersten replied in the argument speaking. At this point, the Cologne theologians found heretical statements in the humanist response. It must certainly have appeared to the humanist scholarship that the scholastics had decided to go all out against their rivals and critics. Humanism would be painted with heresy in the realm of Hebrew studies, but the attack would scarcely stop there. Only the paper fancies of Erasmus's 1516 edition of the New Testament had muffled the severe rumblings from men who had been stung by the plague of science. If Erasmus saw the whole humanist movement might be shattered, moreover, if the scholastics were content to accept their wiretapping this Pfefferkorn, it is a clear case of blockage being surveyed against enlightenment. This looks so much like a great battle for freedom of thought and expression, with truth, all the right people, even all the powerful people, all on one side. This explains the impact of the letters of obscure men, which Voltaire fashions almost blew away the opposition in the goal of laughter, so manifestly stupid did Pfefferkorn and his cohort seem. It might have produced great victories to freedom, and much of the adverse climate of the 18th century might have occurred in the 16th. office might have fallen, liberal paper might have responded too. And then all of a sudden, everything was swallowed up in the loosening papers. The butter, this butter of the book, does not even have a name to go down in history. It is certainly the reason specifically Ben Luther for letting him in his prison. There in 1521, he wrote to Nicholas Barrett, quote, Luther has discredited me and my cause, end quote. Then in the same year, Erasmus wrote to Archbishop Rome, quote, Luther has been sentenced to the world by the genius of discord. Every corner of it has been disturbed by him. Luther's movement was not connected with Lenin, but it was about Lenin into error too, end the quote. To return to the year 1517, despite the troubles of Russia, he had lost his place at Heidelberg and was imprisoned by the Inquisition. Erasmus was still supremely confident of the future. In order to capital, he wrote, quote, at the present I could almost wish to be one of them, for no other reason but this, that I anticipate the near approach of the golden age, so clearly that we see the minds of countries devoting all their energies to the pursuit of peace. The chief movers in this matter are Pope Leo and Francis King of France, end of quote. As regards Leo's case, it is obvious why Erasmus and other humanists could have expected great things from the son of Lorenzo the Magnificent, the great grandson of Casimir. While he possessed a true Medici appreciation of letters and the arts. When until the Lucian controversy arose, Leo satisfied the fondest humanist text. In 1517, Erasmus hailed Leo as, quote, by his own endowment supreme among the supreme, end of quote. And continued to write to him as follows, quote, I congratulate this our age, which bids fair to be an age of gold, if ever such there was. And I see, under your happy auspices and by your holy counsel, first, that truly Christian country, which has in many ways fallen to decay. Secondly, learning of the best church, hitherto partly neglected and partly corrupted, and thirdly, the public and lasting concord of Christendom, the source and poets, our piety and erudition. That these three of the chief blessings of humanity are about to be restored to her. These will be the undying purposes of the church of the earth, which, consecrated to eternal memory by the writings of learned men, will forever render your pontificate and your family illustrious. In the church. Such was the first Erasmian prophecy of the life of Charles, addressed to the women which made it too fine, of whom so much was expected. What if that prophecy had come true? Suppose the humanists had triumphed in the Supper Town Affair, were we too bold to speculate, a few pages back, that this might have ushered in the intellectual climate of the 18th century? Were Erasmus and his fellow humanists 16th century to his earth? The architects of the 18th century lived in the 17th, and of these Descartes was one of the greatest. It might be instructive to ask whether his mind worked in the same way as the God of Erasmus. Did they basically think alike? If you look for a generalization by Erasmus, the text of Luke, quote, who does not perceive that Luther, Descartes, and Voltaire employed the same method, and that they differed only in the greater or less use which their profession should be made of it, end of quote. This gives us more than a bargain for us. We shall have to beg leave to substitute our gentle humanist Erasmus in the place of the first philosopher, Martin Luther. As the university has said, Erasmus laid the edge that Luther had. And he specifically acknowledged the edge. In fact, even though there was some consistency other than biological, he disowned the plant. With or without this human being, we think the prophecy supports this thesis well and perfectly. In the 16th century, the family subjected some of the dogmas of the ancient faith to the scrutiny of private judges, but they still retarded from the discussion of all the rest. In the 17th century, Bacon and the natural sciences, and Descartes and philosophy property, so-called, abolished the school of formulas, destroyed the empire of tradition, by the three of the five of the three. The philosophers of the 18th century, generalizing at length on the same principle, undertook to submit to the private judgment of each man all the objects of his belief. In the case, they supposed the first put more logical, they returned to the first of four precepts, which Descartes set up to test the structure of his Thomist method. The first precept, to accept nothing as true, which I did not clearly recognize to be found. The Tricolis, who considers the entire Cartesian method to be contained in this first precept, perceives that the men of 16th and those in the 17th century, different degrees, restricted, as they deliberately, the field of application of this precept, has the men of the 18th century made it universally applicable. His right to our son. Why particular did Descartes choose to apply his method only to certain matters, although he had made it fit to be applied to all in the case? Particularly, I answer quite simply that its universal applicability could be advanced state only in edges when men social conditions had it become more equal and men more alike in the case. This is not, however, say, why the men of the 17th century applied the principle so much more widely than those of the 16th. There is, I say, this trouble. Logan took the discovery of the first Cartesian precept to Erasmus after a feast to Newton. The Tocqueville is quite correct in recognizing the first Cartesian precept as a form of private judgment. That private judgment and the first precept are not the same thing. Private judgment turned into the first precept, not when the field of application is widened without promoting, but rather when the field of observation and even inquiry is arbitrarily restricted. This is what Erasmus could not do. It is what Descartes and Galileo and Newton could, at any rate, did do. In fact, when the 18th century philosophers widened their field of application to the kind of universal applicability, it would seem that their achievement paradoxically depended upon the severe 17th century restrictions of the field of observation and inquiry. Descartes tells us that this illusion with the teachings of the schools, he sought knowledge and approached the great books of the world and speech. The result would place his conclusion as the opinions of philosophy. Accordingly, like his contemporary Galileo, he acknowledged his mode of observation. We quote essential qualities of things, position, mass, and motion, in order to be accounted to the world. And such great secondary qualities as color, smell, sound, and so forth could be disregarded. Thus was constructed such household cars, coats, an ideal or isolated system, a scheme of scientific facts and made mathematicians for the use of mathematicians in the case. This is the Descartes analyzing the stone. Quote, we may reject hardness because if the stone were liquefied or reduced to powder, it would have no longer possess hardness, and yet would not cease to be a body. That is, we must first reject color, and finally reject cold, heat, and all the qualities of the time, in the case. By a similar description of the field of inquiry and observation, a whole society could be analyzed. Rather than any hint of what Edmund Burke called a quote prescriptive constitution, end of quote, that is a living organism developing and growing over the century. Understand instead quote the imprescriptible rights of man, end of quote, and their frustration. We shall put it bluntly as quote, man was born free and he was otherwise changed. Well, one may apply Cartesian analysis to God. And the odd result, which would have been of particular interest to us. One indeed still discovered the Creator. That is the Creator of a world of things. The author of natural law, a very strict cardinal features of understanding, education, and theory, the most distinctive universal in the sense of the synthesis in humanism, or self and classical literature. As well known, they know the classics, the Catholic Christian, and general education. The second major feature of the Welsh Divine Name was its idea of the union with the sky. And its constant God program designed to produce a well-rounded man. The final starting feature of Renaissance education of theory and the new art practice was its definite inclusion of Christian religion and morality. While it may be true that some of humanists were skeptical, that was certainly not the case with most of them, and the present item was of no education of theory spirit in the war of whom it may be a friend. Because the writings of Renaissance theorists are replete with practical allusions and quotations, and because their views frequently correspond to those of the ancient authors, it has often been observed that Renaissance educational speculation was primarily a resuscitation of the ancient classics, divorced from any major dependence on the medieval. Yet the conclusion by no means necessarily follows from the chemistry. Medieval writers also habitually embrace classical authority. And medieval pedagogy likewise agreed on many of its major lineaments as well as on lesser points of the ancient from which it directly descended. I won't go into any detail on the Renaissance story because I'm sure you're all familiar with it. The quotation of ancient classical writers by Renaissance theorists is frequently in the nature of a collaboration for views whose fundamental reasons are more advanced. But this fashionable is almost imperative. Even as it had been in varying degrees throughout the Middle Ages, to employ extracts from the classics to confirm and adorn one's statements and arguments. It cannot be denied that ancient classical treatises had an important influence on the development of Renaissance education theory. Such an influence, however, was not peculiar to Renaissance speculation as distinguished from that of the Middle Ages. Much of it came through the art, in which it was already deeply embedded. There was a special affinity between Renaissance and ancient writers and pedagogy, inasmuch as each had primarily in view the education of the laity. It was not necessary to make writers many adjustments, as had been the case with medieval affairs, whose pedagogy was featured classy. That is the fundamental consideration. Renaissance theory was for learning. Most of the media had been preferred, and therein lies the difference. During the Middle Ages, down to the 13th century, a number of treatises dealing primarily with the education of folks were composed. Representative of such were works by Cassie Bowles, Isabel of Seville, Rabanus Miles, Darius Dow, Pierre St. Victor, Conrad of Hirschau, and John of Salisbury, all prior to the 13th century. And Isabel is definitely going to be an educational theory, although it's a very poorly education part and a problematic implication. But the others were a work designed to discuss and delineate the way that education part should proceed. The past century was a golden era of medieval pedagogical speculation. In the course of that century, four important treatises on educational theory were composed, two by Frenchman, one by a German, one by an Englishman. They were given Greek title because of the increasing contemporary interest in Greek, although they often used titles of rather strange, third both elements of the Christian as the Middle Ages progressed. Thus, technical grammar was stressed in first cultural engineering accounts. Classical literature in the first half of the 12th century Renaissance, logic in the later part of that period, and philosophy in general in the 13th century. This is all connected with broadening horizons, arising universities, and so on. What is really deserving of remark is not that medieval theory of education designed primarily for cults afforded a supreme position to religious studies, but that it was as liberal as it was. This fact is attested by numerous evidences and sources, including the aforesaid pedagogical treatises. Liberal learning remained in high esteem throughout the period and continued to be cultivated by poets. Its literary, scientific, and philosophical content was progressively expanded. In the past century, Christ, our humanism became so strong that some historians have seen such characterized the world as a one of sin. John of Sales, though writing in defense of logic in 1159, could not resist the temptation to extend his critics to include grammar, refuse Christ in the reading of the authors, to which subject he devotes the full quarter of his work, which is entitled in defense of logic. Of course, he uses logic in the question. Despite the perseverance and revival of considerable literacy during the previous Middle Ages, the first known medieval treatises concerning general education designed especially for the laity were written by Vincent of Beauvais and Egidio Colonna of Giles of Rome in the 13th century. Vincent's treatise, composed during the sunset of the last four ages, was entitled On the Education of Noble Children. That of Egidio, famous for his writing of Dominion, consists of 20 chapters on the education of royal, aristocratic, and upper bourgeois children in his work on the governance of rulers. Both authors were religious, one of Dominican and one of Dominion. Both were highly distinguished and respected, and both had practical experience in taught education as a staff. Now, this is the transition of the medieval party Renaissance education phase. The program outlined by Vincent and Egidio for the general education of lay leaders is broad and generous. It includes the traditional liberal arts of grammar, rhetoric, logic, arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music. The cultivation of literary taste is especially early. Grammar and reading well of course continue to include poetry, grammar, and history. The natural sciences, together with political science and economics, are to be taught, as well as metaphysics and ethics. Even instruction for territory to the knowledge of the state is included. Religion is an important part of education, maritime, and definition of mind. To be included, our social adaptation, inculcation of good manners, and physical as well as military training. After this class, in this discussion in the Renaissance, is the education of girls. It can be readily seen that the education of girls is in video transition. Within remarks, the most fundamental feature of Renaissance education theory was extremism. That the principle of the extensive study of classical Latin and Greek, together with the development of literary style, was firmly rooted in medieval pedagogical tradition. It is true that the intensity of Renaissance enthusiasm for such and consequent dominant place for literary studies and fiction may have been even exposed. It is also true that Renaissance may have had a keen appreciation nurturing itself in the minds of Latin as well. But these features can largely be accounted for by the fact that Renaissance culture was more low than Saracen. Throughout the medieval period, Latin grammar was always recognized as a gateway to and foundation for our learning. And this study definitely included the reading of representative ancient literary masterpieces. The Middle Ages continued the ancient practice of drawing up lists of recommended authors. These works were considered basic in a lot of classics, the same classics. And there were many lists of these, of course. In the 13th century, German draws up a list of 80 of these, pure symbols, which seems to be a philosophy of these works. The Middle Ages also kept considerable stock in the painting of Bible facility in Latin, which accomplishment was known as Alapuncia, highly recommended and praised by John Sarsfield. Although letters no longer retain the bargaining position generally to them firmly in God, its principal forms and themes were studied and implied and even given new applications. Although Athens continued to be a strong and cultural ideal in the Middle Ages, as we anticipate with strongly counterbalanced and narrated and other ideas, such as those of truth and rationality facing humanity. It also designated the universal to show possible grounds, his own but in both all forms of verbal expression and the true culture of God's spirit. Now during the 12th century, medieval theological narrow studies first reached the aperture and then were included from the position of talking to many liberal arts. Study philosophy was on the increase, and something highly good and half gay was the study of the author. However, the theological narrow studies were by no means totally kept. We have, for instance, Daniel Byron and Jules Stendhal, and Germany, for instance, said they didn't have universities as yet. And you place the middle and not there, it seems to continue without much change. And in Italy and in general, of course, the classical arts began to temporary and fluctuating balance was more than restored by the Renaissance Kingdom. And the paper goes on to discuss the room and the side idea and the medieval period. It has been maintained by some even that Renaissance pedagogy was simply the result of grasping earlier medieval monastic academic education and the civil experience of the High Middle Ages. That's an interesting hypothesis, and in fact, it seems like the general idea behind the certain amount of paper. There are always some arguments for this position of the things extreme. At the same time, it is indubitable that the two main elements of the Great Renaissance program, the intellectual academic on the one side and the physical and social on the other, have already been evolved in previous medieval academic and federalist education. On the intellectual academic side, most of the subjects of the Renaissance program are including medieval studies of liberal arts and cultivation of philosophy. The blossoming of philosophy in the Middle Ages really helped to stimulate the development and cultivation of the natural and social sciences, since they were of course included in philosophy and philosophy. There were physical and social changes. Formal education needed a lay off in social history of two types, social and civil. In the education side, the inculcation of social issues and adaptation to community living was considered indispensable. Whatever types were being changed to perform a different function of society, which was social education. Although it meant more, of course, the society got received to those things compared to low life. The latter type of training was to be found together with education. And, of course, there are some other thoughts. It is to be observed, interestingly, that most Renaissance treatises on pedagogy, directed and so on, were addressed to members of the lay aristocracy. Regarding the final saving feature of Renaissance education, there is certain religious and moral aspects that can be made by addressing heresies. The hypothesis is a formal advance that medieval education is in practice, coupled with existing conditions and needs, provided a sufficient background for the dancing philosophical program. What to start with a word of explanation, if you detect a kind of retrospective quality in certain parts of this paper, the reason is that in reality, it forms the conclusion of a study and work out on the Greek epic. It had nothing prepared for this occasion, and the professor of Paul Miller graciously gave me permission to read from this study. In an article which revealed an admirable grasp of the field of French literature in the 16th century, and of the relationship of that literature to its classical sources, Professor James Sutton of Cornell University made the following illuminating observation. The Renaissance represents the historical moment when European thought was ready to come to terms with the whole of its ancient heritage, and not merely with some part of it. One of the more remarkable illustrations of this process was the literary activity of Rorschach and his colleagues. What is absolutely certain, says Gilbert Hammett, is that Rorschach was the founder of elevated lyric poetry and classical manner, not only for France, but for all modern Europe. Taken together, these two statements constitute the dynamic premises of the present remains. For it cannot be a matter of indifference whether a poet to whom the Western world is so greatly indebted was able to come to terms with our ancient heritage in the most direct and rewarding manner, through a knowledge of some of the fundamental literary texts of antiquity in the language with which they were written. In antiquity, the poet, and Homer especially, were honored as possessing an almost encyclopedic understanding of things terrestrial, internal, and celestial. In spite of the severe reservations that Plato frequently expresses about the religious and social aspects of poetry, Homer must have represented for him the summation of some of the highest values of Greek civilization. Otherwise, Socrates could hardly have been made to stay in the Republic, as he was about to attack the basis of Homer's art. I have always, from my earliest youth, had an awe and love of Homer, which even now makes the world closer. Yes, of course. Yes. The French name for the beginning. Otherwise, Socrates could hardly have been made to stay in the Republic as he was about to attack the basis of Homer's art. I have always, from my earliest youth, had an awe and love of Homer, which even now makes the words shorter on my lips. There is perhaps a good deal of conviction mingled with the irony in the following conversation between Socrates and a rhapsode, Ion. Socrates, does not Homer speak of the same things which all other poets handle? Is not war his great argument? And does he not speak of human society and of intercourse of men, good and bad, skilled and unskilled, and of the gods conversing with one another and with mankind, and about what happens in heaven and in the world below, and the generations of gods and heroes, are not these the themes of his famous things? Very true, Socrates. And do not the other poets sing of the same? Yes, Socrates, but not in the same way as him. But in a worse way? Yes, in a far worse. And Homer in a better way, he was incomparably better. The earliest mention of Homer among Greek writers is that of Xenophanes, who describes him as the teacher of Greek. From the beginning, all have learned from him, said Xenophanes. This opinion must have been widely held in Greece for Socrates to be able to say, then Glaucon, whenever you meet with eulogists of Homer who tell you that he has educated Greek, it will be your duty to greet them affectionately as excellent men and to admit that Homer is first and greatest among tragic poets. But Homer was more than a teacher and more than a poet. He was the poet. In every period of Greek literature, and indeed of Greek art, Homer is the outstanding criterion of all that is aesthetically matchless. And this tribute is paid to him even by those who, like Hesiod, Pythagoras, Heraclitus, and Xenophanes and Plato themselves, raise serious objections of an ethical and religious nature to certain aspects of the Homeric epic. But Odysseus has one fame far beyond all his sufferings, says Pindar, thanks to the sweet ways of Homer. for 106 years, and on his ring of joy for the rest of the 7 days. And the greatest of the lower poets pays this further tribute to the first of the upper poets, when he says that Ajax in death is honored throughout all the world by Homer. For whatsoever one hath well said, goeth forth with a voice that never dies, and thus over the future earth and sea hath cast the light of noble deeds, unquenchable forever. In these words, Pindar strikes the note that will continue to sound in all the literature of the occidental world. He states the principle of Homer's greatness, the beautiful expression of noble deeds. The notion of a possible divorce between the ethical and aesthetic realms is foreign to the thinking of Pindar, as it was to that of Homer and to the Greeks generally. The inexhaustible vitality of Homer results from the union of these two, the ethical and aesthetic, at the level of the highest intensity of each. Ronsard's epic, the Saint-Pierre, was the most sustained poetic effort and the most grievous disappointment of Ronsard's career. Nevertheless, it would be a mistake, I think, to see in the relative failure of his poem more than an incident of minor importance against the background of his achievement in introducing the Greek epic into French literature and self. Ronsard enters upon the scene from the dawn of Homeric influence created by the timid efforts of Jean Lemaire, for whom diptych and dialect were the authentic voices, by the circumscribed knowledge of Clément Marot, aware of little besides the legends of Helen of Troy and of Odysseus, brightened somewhat by the superior but still sporadic information of Rabelais, and by the partial translations of Salal and Tertius. But the scene is entirely transformed within a few years of Ronsard's appearance, and by the time he prepares to say, farewell, pleasant sunlight, and we must abandon home and orchards and gardens, the Homeric, the Hellenic sun is shining in broad day upon the gardens cultivated by the poet of Vendôme and Turenne. To be sure, he was not alone. His generation was distinguished by a score of poets and writers, many of whom shared his admiration for Greece and contributed greatly to the renewal and transmission of her literary traditions. Like his colleagues of the Pléiades, he owed a great debt to their guide, Jean Barrin, who pointed out the difficult road to them and was able to reveal some of the intellectual and spiritual riches that awaited them if they persevered. But the guide could not, even if he would, take from his disciples the trail of that road. It is clear that it was in the nature of the reward that caused Ronsard to find delight in the trail itself. After some years, he was able to discover his own way, perhaps even with a taste purer than his nature. He soon was able to study Homer and the other Greek poets independently, and even to excel the official translators, both in poetic insight and literary fidelity. In the end, once the reality of the fact has been established, the poet's capacity for literary fidelity to a great text would matter least, or not at all, if it were not sometimes the ground of deep poetic insight. The imaginative transformations that occur in this time are based upon that exact understanding of the text which admitted him to the living thought of him. From this encounter, with which the name of Virgil, one of the greatest of the Homerides, was indissolubly associated, Ronsard brought back a criterion of excellence whose influence in his own work was constant and not limited to the epic composition. His manner of presenting and extolling this criterion is often banal or beautifully programmatic, but there are moments when it becomes a vision of perfection in which exaltation and despair struggle for the possession of Raphael's name. The vision and the struggle could never have been absent from herself once the French yard had begun to assume form, even as an outline. They are already explicit in the dialogue of the muses and Raphael. They are revived at the end of the last chapter to his epic in the verses that begin, "Homer renowned in knowledge and in name," and are there consummated and resolved in humility. "Upon thy knees, Pantheon, worship the Iliad, adore the Iliad." As one considers Raphael's achievements, one is astonished at the magnitude of his polemic legacy. He gave to France, at an important turning point in her literary history, the example of a church who was by profoundest information of humans. It was an example of immediate and lasting efficacy. The whole generation of his creators, not to mention his successors, issued directly from him, as he affirmed with a proud assurance that history has ratified. It is not since 54 that the sickening power of his influence reached backward into time, for the literary standards that he set resist the style of his poet older than he. Perhaps the greatest tribute paid to Raphael by his contemporaries is not to be sought in the praise of his fame, but in the sense that even his adversaries could attack him only with the arms that he had created, arms beaten out often enough upon an epic anvil. Du Bastan and Daubigny revered Raphael in their epic writings, for in spite of the grotesque expressions of style of the first and the exaggerated though sincere passion of the second, the fundamental movement of their verse took its step from that of Raphael, and their music, whether melodious or harsh, was transferred in his pages. The cry, thrice repeated, "They have lied, brother," by which Raphael asserts his absolute superiority over Du Bastan, is less the expression of a private literary egotism than the noble assertion of a magnanimous man. The value of Raphael's example lay in the fact that he showed the way back to the living source of much that is greatest in incidental literature. It has been truly said that one may glean from the despised Pantheon a sheaf of passages that would make the glory of many a poet. The seed for that sheaf was largely gathered from the Iliad, the Odyssey, and the Homeric hymns, from the Agonatica of Apollonius' Road, the Theogony, and the works and days of Cicero, either directly or in the writings of the epic historian of Greece. But this seed could not be parsimoniously reserved for sowing in the epic field. It fell in every corner of Raphael's enamored garden and sprang into lovely flower among the odes, the elegies, the hymns, the sonnets. The sonnet to Marie de Clare, "Comment voir que la branche n'admet la rose," to my mind his greatest, is drawn from her nice grain. So I am more than half persuaded that if one were to study the famous sonnet to Hélène de Surville, "When we shall have grown quite old in the evening by the light of the candle, seated at the house and unwinding the stone and spinning, you will say, as you sing my verses in London, 'Raphael celebrated me in the time when my duty yet lived.' Then, no servant of your house, as she hears this tidings, Their hat gliding on her path, but they stopped in her slumber at the sound of Raphael's name.